Ellery's, should that behavior interfere with my witness's composure? Judge Brown nodded.
If you can find fault with our guest's behavior before I do, Mr. Picton, I should be very surprised, but please feel free to let me know if it happens. Now, get on with it.
With another deep breath, Mr. Picton looked over at Iphigenia Blaylock. The state calls Clara Hatch. Turning to the big mahogany doors, Mr. Picton nodded to the guard, Henry, who opened one door and said, Clara Hatch, in a low but firm voice. And in they came. The little girl in the simple summer dress, her left hand holding her right, followed by Mr. and Mrs. Weston, who looked like they were being scorched by the burning stares of every pair of eyes in the room. The folks in the galleries were mostly people the Westons had known for years, but at moments like that, years of knowledge and friendship can be knocked down and trampled by the greater pressures of confusion, suspicion, and plain and simple fear. Once again, Clara searched out the crowd before her with quick turns of her little head, and when she found the doctor's face, she stayed locked on it as if he were a lighthouse that might guide the little ship of her life back into safe port after it had weathered the storm what lay beyond the oak rail at the end of the aisle. And as she looked at the doctor, I turned to look at Libby Hatch. The girl's mother, her blood mother, as Mr. Picton had cleverly put it, saw that Clara's eyes were fixed on the doctor, and the pleading, loving expression what the woman had managed to shoehorn into her features in hopes of appealing to Clara quickly soured into an expression of jealousy and hate. But once the little girl was guided onto the other side of the rail by the bailiff, Libby managed to get her face rearranged yet again. And though it wasn't quite as affectionate as it had been before, it was still closer to that mark than anything I'd ever seen her exhibit to date. About halfway to the stand, Clara stopped walking, as if she could feel the pair of golden eyes boring into the back of her head. Then she slowly turned to take in the woman in the black dress, who smiled gently at her before suddenly putting her hands to her mouth with a gasp and sobbing just once. Looking strangely calm, little Clara said three simple words, "Don't cry, Mama," in a voice what couldn't have been more grown-up or more considerate, and the sound of those words struck every person in the galleries as dumb as the witness herself had been for the last 3 years. Turning again, Clara climbed on into the witness box and held up her good left hand, following the procedure what the doctor had spent long hours preparing her for. Bailiff Coffey, having been alerted by Mr. Picton, took the girl's lifeless right hand and placed it on his Bible. "Do you solemnly swear," he said, softer than was his habit, "that the testimony you are about to give in this court—"
"I do,"
Clara said, jumping the gun in her first outright show of nerves. Bailiff Coffey just held up a finger, telling her to wait. "Shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth— So help you God."
"I do,"
Clara repeated, her face going a little red. "State your full name, please," Bailiff Coffey said.
"Clara Jessica Hatch,"
she answered softly. Then, at a signal from Coffey, she sat down. Clara glanced at her mother quickly again, but just as quickly turned away to look at the doctor once more. He gave her a firm little nod to let her know that she was doing just fine. Finally, Mr. Picton stood up to approach the witness box. "Hello, Clara," he said, in a careful but still chipper sort of way. The girl opened her mouth to respond, but only managed a nod as she pulled her right hand up onto her lap. "Clara," Mr. Picton continued, "I'd like you to tell these gentlemen," he held a hand up to the jury box, "everything that happened on the night of May the 31st, 3 years ago, in your own words. Can you do that for me, Clara?" The girl paused, trying hard now not to look at her mother. After a few seconds, she nodded. "Then, please," Mr. Picton continued, "go ahead." As she took a deep breath, the fingers of Clara's left hand locked onto her numb right forearm, gripping it hard. Letting the air out of her lungs, she began her story in that same scratchy but brave voice.
"We went to town, to buy some things, and then to the lake.
Lake Saratoga? Mr. Picton asked.
Yes. Sometimes we'd go there in the summer, to watch the sun go down, and sometimes they have fireworks. But Tommy was getting sleepy before the fireworks started, and Matthew's tummy wasn't so good on account of because he ate so many butterscotches, so Mama said we'd better go on home.
Mama? Mr. Picton asked. Clara, do you see your Mama anywhere right now?
The girl nodded quickly.
Can you point to her, please?
Glancing up ever so briefly, Clara stole a look at Libby and then bent her head back down as she pointed toward the defense table.
Let the record state, Mr. Picton said, that the witness recognizes the accused, Mrs. Elspeth Hunter, as being her mother, the former Mrs. Elspeth Hatch, more commonly known as Libby Hatch.
Mr. Picton drew closer to the witness box and softened his voice again.
All right, Clara. Tell me, did you want to leave the lake that night?
The girl shook her head, being careful to keep her braid behind her.
No, sir. I wanted to see the rockets.
And your Mama? Did she want to see the rockets, too?
Yes, but she said we had to get Tommy and Matthew home.
Was she happy about that?
No, sir. She was kind of mad. She got kind of mad sometimes.
Did she say anything that let you know she was kind of mad?
Clara nodded once again, though reluctantly.
She said what she wanted didn't matter, didn't ever matter, that she always had to take care of us instead of doing what she liked.
Did she tell you what she would have liked exactly?
Clara shrugged, or at least her one good shoulder did.
I figured she meant seeing the rockets.
Letting the girl take a few breaths to steady herself, Mr. Picton waited before saying,
Now then, Clara, you got into your wagon to go home?
Yes, sir.
Did your mother do anything, being as she was so angry?
Clara's face went puzzled.
She didn't spank us or anything, if that's what you mean. She just told me to get the boys into the wagon and then we left.
Told you?
Mr. Picton asked, moving over to the jury and plastering a look of surprise on his face.
She didn't put the boys into the wagon?
She tried, Clara answered, but Matthew started to cry, so she just told me to do it and went down to the water to wash her face.
Mr. Picton looked at the jury, which you might call meaningfully.
Did she often ask you to take care of the boys?
Nodding, Clara looked down at her hands again.
Mm-hmm. It was my job.
Mr. Picton nodded, still studying the jury, who were starting to look as wide-eyed and confused as Sheriff Dunning had when he'd come out of the grand jury hearing.
I see, Mr. Picton said. That was your job. And once the boys were in the wagon?
Then Mama came up from the water, and we started to drive home,
Clara answered. But the words weren't as strong as they had been to that point. Mr. Picton, hearing the change, came back over to her and stood so that his body blocked Clara's view of Libby, and vice versa.
But you didn't get home, did you, Clara?
Seeming relieved that her mother was out of sight, Clara shook her head with more certainty.
No, sir.
And why not?
Another deep breath, and another look at the doctor, and Clara went on.
We drove back through town, and we were on the road home.
The Charlton Road?
Mr. Picton asked. Clara nodded.
All of a sudden, Mama drove the wagon over under a big tree off the road. It was dark by then, and I didn't know why she stopped. It was scary on that road.
And where were you sitting at that time?
I was in the back, holding on to Tommy so's he didn't bother Matthew. He was asleep by then.
Matthew was?
Yes, sir. And I didn't want Tommy to wake him up so's he'd start crying about his stomach again. It bothered Mama. I asked her why we stopped. She didn't say anything for a few minutes, just sat up on the bench, staring at the road. I asked her again, and then she got down and came around to the back of the wagon. She had her bag in her hand. She said she had something important she needed to tell us.
Hearing Clara's voice start to trail off again, Mr. Picton said,
"It's all right, Clara. What did she tell you?"
"She said that she'd stopped. She'd stopped."
"Clara?" The girl's eyes had gone glassy, and for a minute my heart sank, thinking that she'd shrunk back into the horrified silence what had gripped her for so long. I saw the doctor's jaw set hard, and I knew that he was worrying about the same thing. We both started breathing again, though, when Clara near whispered,
"She said that she'd seen our dada."
Judge Brown leaned over, cupping one of his big ears with his hand. "I'm afraid you'll have to speak up a little, young lady, if you can," he said. Looking up at him and swallowing hard, Clara repeated,
"She said that she'd seen our dada. She said he told her he was with God. She said that he told her God wanted us to be with him, too."
Mr. Picton nodded grimly, glancing to the jury box. "For the jury's information, Clara's father, Daniel Hatch, passed away on December the 29th, 1893, approximately 6 months before the night in question. The cause was a sudden—" Here Mr. Picton turned around to look at Libby. "A very sudden and unexplained attack of heart disease." "Your Honor," Mr. Darrow said, standing up as quick as he could, "this kind of innuendo—" "Mr. Picton," the judge agreed, nodding to Mr. Darrow and then looking at the assistant district attorney, "I've warned you—"
"Your Honor, I suggest nothing,"
Mr. Picton said, his eyes going wide and innocent. "The plain truth is that every medical man in Ballston Spa examined Daniel Hatch during his illness and could find no explanation for his condition." "Then say that," Judge Brown replied. "Half-truths are not better than lies, sir. Continue with your questions." Mr. Picton turned to Clara once more, letting his voice go soft again.
"And what did you think that your mama meant when she said that your dada told her that God wanted you to be with him?"
Clara's left shoulder shrugged again.
"I didn't know. I thought she meant that someday, but—"
Nodding, Mr. Picton said,
"But that wasn't what she meant, was it?"
Clara shook her head, this time hard enough to move the braid, and as the scar on the back of her neck became visible, I noted that one or two of the jurors caught sight of it, and silently pointed it out to the others.
"She opened her bag," Clara said, "and she took out Dada's gun."
"Dada's gun?" Mr. Picton asked. "How did you know it was your Dada's gun?"
"He kept it under his pillow," Clara answered, "and he showed it to me once. He told me never to touch it unless somebody bad was in the house. Somebody who was stealing, or—" "Mama left it there after he died."
The girl's voice trailed off, and her face began to get frightened, frightened in a way what even looking to the doctor didn't seem to help. Knowing that he'd reached a very dangerous point, Mr. Picton moved in closer to ask,
"What happened then, Clara?" "Mama, she—"
Clara's head began to shiver a little, and the left side of her body followed. Wrapping her good arm around herself, she worked hard to go on.
"Mama came up into the wagon. She woke up Matthew and told me to give Tommy to him. So I did. Then she looked at me again. She told me it was time to go see Dada and God, that it would be a better place, and we had to do what God wanted."
Tears filled the girl's eyes and started to roll down her face, but she never really cried as such, just grabbed herself tighter and tried to keep going.
"She touched me with the gun."
"Where did she touch you, Clara?" Mr. Picton asked. The girl pointed to her upper chest, finally letting out just one choking sob.
"And then?" "I remember she pulled the trigger, and there was a big bang. But that's all,"
Clara answered, getting a better hold of herself.
"I don't remember anything more. Not until I was in my bed at home."
Mr. Picton nodded, letting out a deep breath of his own.
All right, Clara, it's all right. We can talk about something else now if you want.
Clara wiped her face with her hand and said,
Okay.
After giving her a couple of minutes, Mr. Picton asked, in a louder voice,
Clara, do you remember Reverend Parker?
He gave the services at our church, and he came out to visit Mama and Dada sometimes.
And what did he do when he came out to visit?
He'd come to dinner, Clara answered. And sometimes he'd go for walks with Mama.
Dada didn't like to go. He said the air was bad for him. Did your Mama ever take you or the boys along?
Clara shook her head.
She said it wasn't our place.
Mr. Picton reached into the box to touch the girl's left arm, looking very relieved.
Thank you, Clara, he said.
Then he added, not caring whether it was loud enough for anybody else to hear him,
You've been a very brave young lady.
Turning to walk back to his table, Mr. Picton then stood and looked at the judge and the jury.
The state has no more questions for this witness, Your Honor.
He sat down, leaving Clara exposed to the full power of her mother's eyes. Libby had reacted to her daughter's testimony very much the way that the doctor had predicted she would. First, she'd tried quiet tears and hand-wringing. Then she'd bobbed her head around, trying to get Clara to look at her. Then, when Mr. Picton stepped in to make sure Clara couldn't see her, the tears and head-bobbing had stopped, and she'd settled into still silence, while her eyes filled again with that cold, hateful glare. But had the jury been able to see that? Or was it only the few of us what knew her full history who'd been able to read Libby's face? Looking terribly alone, without Mr. Picton nearby, Clara turned her eyes downward once more and started moving her lips silently. Seeing the near desperation on the girl's face, the judge leaned over toward her.
Clara, he said, are you able to go on now?
With a start, Clara looked up at him.
Go on?
She asked softly.
The defense must question you now, the judge answered with just about the only smile I ever saw him exhibit during the trial.
Oh, Clara answered, like maybe she'd forgotten. Yes, I can go on, sir.
The judge sat back, looking to the defense table.
All right, Mr. Darrow.
During the whole of Mr. Picton's examination of Clara, Mr. Darrow's hands had been folded in front of his face so that it had been pretty tough to tell what he was thinking or how he was reacting. But when he stood up for his cross-examination, all the deep worry and occasional outrage what we'd seen him exhibit to this point seemed gone, and his features became open and relaxed in a way what Clara pretty obviously considered a relief.
"Thank you, Your Honor,"
Mr. Darrow said, gently smiling and moving toward the witness box. But he moved at an angle what made it impossible for Clara to get any more looks at the doctor. Life is never more tit for tat than when you're in a courtroom.
"Hello, Clara," he said as he got closer to her. "I know this isn't easy, so I'm going to try to get you out of here as soon as I can."
Clara just dropped her eyes as an answer.
"Clara, you say the next thing you remember is waking up in your house. Is that right?"
At another nod from the girl, Mr. Darrow went on.
"But I don't guess you thought you'd had a bad dream, did you?"
"No,"
Clara answered.
"I was hurt."
"Yes," Mr. Darrow said, fairly oozing sympathy. "You were hurt pretty bad. And you'd been asleep for a long time. Did you know that?"
"They told me later. The doctors did."
"A long sleep can make people confused sometimes. I know if I sleep too long, I sometimes don't even know where I am or how I got there when I wake up."
"I knew where I was,"
Clara said, softly but firmly.
"I was at home."
"Good girl.
the doctor whispered, craning his neck in an effort to get a look at her but not wanting to be obvious about it.
"Of course you were," Mr. Darrow said. "But did you know everything else? I mean, as soon as you woke up, did you remember everything else?"
As if she couldn't help herself, Clara again glanced over at her mother, who had her hands folded on the defense table like she was pleading for something, while her eyes had filled with tears. Seeing this, Clara bobbed her head back down like she'd been jerked with a rope and said,
"I remember Mama screaming and crying. She said that Matthew and Tommy were dead. I didn't understand. I tried to get up and ask her, but the doctor gave me some medicine. I went back to sleep."
"And when you woke up the second time?"
"Mama was next to my bed with the doctors."
"Did your mama tell you anything?"
"She said that we'd all been attacked by a man. A crazy man. She said he'd killed Matthew and Tommy."
Tears now slowly streaming down her face again, Clara added,
"I started to cry. I wanted to see my brothers, but Mama said I couldn't ever, ever again."
"I see," Mr. Darrow told her. Then he pulled a handkerchief, one what was a lot neater than the clothes it had been concealed in, out of his breast pocket.
"Would you like to use this?"
Clara took the white piece of linen and wiped her face.
"Clara, how long after that did your mama go away?"
"Soon, I think. I don't know, not for sure."
"But was she with you all that time before she left?"
Clara nodded.
"Her and Louisa, our housekeeper. The doctors sometimes, too, and Mr. Picton visited."
"I'm sure he did,"
Mr. Darrow said, looking over at the jury.
"And what did your mama tell you before she went away?"
Stealing another look at Libby, Clara answered,
"That she had to go find us a new place to live. So we didn't have to live in that house. It was too sad," she said. "Dada was dead, and Tommy and Matthew, too. She told me she'd find a new place and come back to take me away when she did."
"And did you believe her?"
"Yes."
"Did you usually believe your mama?"
"Yes, except..."
"Except?"
"Except when she got mad sometimes. Then sometimes she would say things that..." "I didn't believe her. I don't think she meant them, though."
"I see,"
Mr. Darrow said, turning his body away from her without moving from his spot on the floor.
"So the last things you now remember about that night on the Charlton Road are your mama touching you with the gun, then pulling the trigger, and after that there was a loud noise?"
"Yes."
"But you didn't remember it when you woke up?"
Clara shook her head.
"And you can't remember anything about what happened to Tommy and Matthew?"
I didn't see what happened."
"You're sure?"
"Yes."
"And so your mama went away, and you went to live with Mr. and Mrs. Weston. Is that right?"
Clara nodded.
"And did you remember anything about what happened that night during the time you lived with them?"
"Not..."
Here Clara worked very hard, pretty obviously to remember something.
"Not so's I could talk about it, or show it. Only so's I could see it in my head."
Mr. Darrow spun quickly to the girl, causing her to start a bit and try, without success, to look at the doctor.
"That's quite a mouthful for a little girl. Not so's you could talk about it or show it, but so's you could see it in your head. You think of that all by yourself?"
Clara looked down quickly.
"It's the way it was."
"Did you think of that all by yourself, Clara?"
Mr. Darrow repeated. Then, without waiting for an answer, he moved in closer.
Or isn't it in fact true that Dr. Kreitzler led you to see it that way and told you to use those words when it came time to tell the story in court?
Mr. Picton was out of his chair like the seat was lined with hot coals. Your Honor, the state protests. We asked for special treatment of this witness, and what do we get? Leading and badgering.
Before the judge could answer, Mr. Darrow was holding up a hand. I will withdraw the question, Your Honor, and try to make my questions more palatable to the state.
Again smiling at the witness, Mr. Darrow asked, Clara,
when did you first start to remember what happened that night? I mean, remember it so that you could talk about it.
Clara shrugged, her face looking even more worried after the short but sharp exchange between the lawyers.
Not too long ago, I guess.
Before you met Dr. Kreitzler?
Clara reluctantly shook her head.
After you met Dr. Kreitzler?
Clara didn't move.
Or was it when you met Dr. Kreitzler?
Mr. Picton was up again. Your Honor, with all due respect, which question does the learned counsel from Illinois wish the witness to answer?
Sit down, Mr. Picton, Judge Brown replied. The counsel for the defense is within his rights.
Thank you, Your Honor, Mr. Darrow said.
Well, Clara?
I never forgot,
the girl answered, more tears coming as she did.
I never forgot. Not really.
And what didn't you forget? You never knew what happened to Tommy and Matthew. That's fine, you've told us that, so you couldn't and don't remember it. But what did you know that you didn't forget?
I never...
Looking up at the bench pleadingly, Clara said,
I don't know what he means.
I mean, Clara, Mr. Darrow went on, being a little firmer now, what was it that you know that you never forgot, and what was it that you know that you forgot and only remembered not too long ago?
Her body shaking once, Clara finally let out a sob as she looked from the judge to Mr. Darrow and then tried to peer around the lawyer at the doctor who, for his part, was also desperately attempting to get himself into position to be seen by her.
What the devil? The doctor whispered. He's deliberately attempting to confuse her.
I don't understand, Clara said again, openly crying now.
Clara, Mr. Darrow went on, it's very simple.
It's not, the girl cried. I don't understand.
Which is which? Mr. Darrow said, surprising everyone in the room by letting his voice get stern, even a bit harsh. What did you always know, and what did you forget but remember not too long ago, perhaps at about the time that you met Dr. Kreitzler, and perhaps when you met Dr. Kreitzler? Clara, you must
stop it!
A voice called out, silencing both the lawyer and the mumbling what had started in the galleries. The entire room turned to the defense table, where Libby Hatch was, like her daughter, in tears.
Leave her alone! She shouted at Darrow. You can't treat her like this, not with what she's been through. If she doesn't remember, then she doesn't. Stop browbeating my child. Stop it. Stop.
Throwing her face into her hands, Libby collapsed onto the table as the crowd started to hum like a hive again, causing Judge Brown to smash his gavel down. The defendant will get herself under control, he ordered, and so will the galleries. Mr. Darrow, the court would like to know.
If it please the court, Your Honor, Mr. Darrow said quickly, the defense will forego the remainder of its questions to this witness. Under the circumstances, we ask for an adjournment until tomorrow morning.
The noise of the crowd grew louder at that, and the judge set to rapping away.
Silence! I won't have another sound!
As his order began to take effect, the judge set his gavel aside, looking very displeased.
The witness is excused, he called, and court is adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, at which time I'd better see some radically different behavior, or I will close these proceedings.
A final rap, and Bailiff Coffey moved to help Clara, who was weeping heavily now, down out of the witness box. Mr. Picton rushed over to lend a hand, but the little girl's tormented eyes were fixed on her apparently devastated mother.
Don't cry, Mama.
Clara called once more as she was led away. But her tone was very different now. All the grown-up quality was gone, and the desperation in her words was underlined by the weight of her sobs.
Don't cry. It's going to help you. It's supposed to help you, they told me.
Libby Hatch never looked up. Sensing what was happening, the doctor moved quickly for the gate in the railing, but when Clara saw him, her anguish only appeared to get worse, and she ran past him down the center aisle to Mr. and Mrs. Weston, who rushed her out of first the room and then the building. The judge had already departed, and as the jury moved to do the same, Mr. Darrow got Libby to her feet and moved her in the direction of the side door down to her cell. But before either she or jury had exited, she began to wail. "She doesn't remember. She doesn't remember. How can you expect her to? She's just a child. Oh, my poor Clara, my poor baby." At that, Mr. Darrow turned to the jury box, looking uneasy, but the sight of their confused faces seemed to reassure him, and he gave the guard who'd been standing behind Iphigenia Blaylock the okay to take his client on downstairs. With things finally settling down, Mr. Picton made his way over to the doctor. The look what they exchanged indicated nothing good, and I certainly didn't have any trouble understanding why. The rest of our group crowded round, also looking deeply troubled. Only Mr. Moore was scratching his head. "Well," he said, "if you ask me, Vanderbilt's throwing his money away. Imagine trying to bully an 8-year-old girl like that. Darrow must be crazy. Hell, even her own mother..." Then he suddenly stopped, watching the rest of our faces. He finally realized what we'd already grasped. "Damn it!" he seethed quietly, with a stamp of his foot. "I hate being the last one to get these things. He planned the whole scene, didn't he?" "Son of a bitch," Marcus said, more amazed than angry. He took an unmitigated disaster for his client and turned it into a possible advantage. "And she played her part perfectly," Mr. Picton said regretfully. Then he turned to Mr. Moore. "Men like Vanderbilt do not maintain their stations in life by making stupid choices, John." He hissed once and slapped at the railing. "What the hell does Darrow care if people think he's callous, if at the same time he can make the jury believe that Libby genuinely loves her daughter and wouldn't do anything to hurt her?" I looked up at the doctor, whose face had gone a little pale. He turned to stare at the mahogany doors as if he thought Clara might come back into the room. But all he saw, all any of us saw, was the crowd filing out, some of them turning back to give our group what might politely be called very unsympathetic glances. Feeling for his chair, the doctor swayed back and then sat on it, his features suddenly going very ashen. The kind of ashen they'd gone, I realized with some dread, when he'd gotten the news about Polly McPherson. As I stood there watching him, I felt a little tug at my arm and turned to find El Niño giving me a grave look.
"Señorito Stevie,"
he said, trying not to be heard by the others,
"this is not a good thing."
"No," I answered, "it ain't." The Aborigine considered that and then nodded, straightened his white silk tie, and put his hands to his hips.
"This man Darrow, you are certain I should not kill him?"
"Actually," I answered, shaking my head, "I'm beginning to wonder." Chapter 45. Spirits were very depressed around Mr. Picton's house that night, all the more so because at the start of the day we'd figured that the afternoon's events would put us pretty firmly in control of the case. Instead, the clever Mr. Darrow had battled us to what amounted to a draw, or maybe worse. He'd made Clara look unsure and confused, and he'd planted the idea that her confidence and maybe even her story had been the doctor's work, not her own. True, the facts, as she'd recalled them, worked to our favor, but as anybody who's ever been involved with the law will tell you, facts aren't always or even usually what decides a case. And so we didn't talk much during dinner, the adults putting most of their energy into making another good-sized dent in Mr. Picton's wine cellar. After the meal, Marcus and Mr. Moore took the trolley on up to Saratoga to try to get an idea of what the general public's reaction to Clara's testimony had been, though the answer to that question seemed pretty obvious. As for me, I found that nightfall brought more worries about Cat. Anna Linares was still on my mind, too, as she was on everybody else's. But the thought of what would happen if Libby got off, went back to New York, and found Cat trying to protect the baby tugged at my heart and my stomach in a way what I found I just couldn't control. After dinner, I went for a long walk, and when I came back I just sat out on the front porch of the house, still trying to think my way out of what I was feeling by telling myself that Kat should have already left New York, that she only had herself to blame for her new predicament. But it didn't really work. The more I considered the problem, the more it brought me to a state of mind what was typical when it came to my dealings with Kat, a kind of frustrated sadness, and underneath it a sense that somehow I was to blame for at least part of the situation. Wrapped up in such cogitations and emotions, I barely noticed the sound of the screen door opening behind me. I knew it was the doctor. He'd been able to read my worried face at dinner, and it would have been like him to want to make sure I was all right. I didn't feel much like talking. As usual, the subject of Kat only made me feel stupid when I discussed it with other people, and so I was grateful when he just sat beside me and didn't say a thing. We listened to the crickets for a time, and traded a few short comments about a swarm of fireflies that were giving a good imitation of the starry sky above us out of Mr. Picton's front lawn. Other than that, though, we stayed wrapped up in our separate worries. It was plain what the doctor was thinking. The moment when Clara Hatch had run past him and out the door of the courtroom had been a terrible one, and had caused him to wonder whether he'd done right by the little girl, or if he hadn't, in fact, been using her for his own purposes instead of helping her. There wasn't anything I could tell him. I honestly didn't know how I felt about it. Maybe silence and forgetting would have been better, part of me thought, for somebody like Clara Hatch. Maybe facing the devils of your past, especially at such a young age, was just a painful waste. Maybe the key to life, despite everything the doctor believed and had spent his life working on, was to just put the ugliness what you encounter, what every person encounters, behind you, and get on with things. Maybe memory was just a wicked curse, and the kind of mind what could wipe out painful recollections a blessing. Maybe. We were still sitting there on the porch when Mr. Moore and Marcus came wandering up. Catching sight of them, the doctor stood and called out, "Did you see White?" Mr. Moore nodded, holding up a small envelope. "We saw him." They reached the steps, and Mr. Moore handed the envelope to the doctor. "He didn't have much to say, though." "There's more," Marcus added, as the rest of our group, drawn by the returning men's voices, came out onto the porch. "Several other guests arrived at the Grand Union today, courtesy of Mr. Vanderbilt."
"Defense witnesses?"
Miss Howard asked. Marcus nodded, then looked to his brother. "They're bringing in Hamilton, Lucius." The younger Isaacson's eyes went wide. "Hamilton? You're joking!" Marcus shook his head as Mr. Picton asked, "And who is Hamilton?" "Dr. Albert Hamilton of Auburn, New York," Marcus said. "Though there's no proof that he actually has a doctorate of any kind. He used to sell patent medicine. Now he passes himself off as an expert in everything from ballistics to toxicology to anatomy. A complete charlatan, but he's made quite a name for himself as a legal expert, and he's fooled a lot of smart people. Sent a lot of innocent ones to the gallows, too."
"And Darrow's engaged him?" Mr. Picton asked.
Marcus nodded. "My guess is you'll get a request for the gun and the bullets first thing in the morning so Hamilton can run his own tests on them."
"But that's ridiculous," Lucius said. "Hamilton will say anything the people paying him want him to say."
"Which is the easiest way to become a successful expert witness," Mr. Picton grunted. "Anybody else?"
"Yes," Mr. Moore answered. "And I do not like the possibilities involved with this one. Darrow wants somebody he can present as an expert on feminine psychology and character. Someone fairly local, who the crowd will be familiar with and maybe even sympathetic to." He turned to Miss Howard. "It's your friend, Mrs. Katie Stanton, Sarah."
"Mrs. Katie Stanton?"
Miss Howard repeated.
"But she was there," Cyrus commented, looking worried. "When we had the sketch made, she knows we've been after the woman."
"Exactly why Darrow wants her, I suspect," Marcus said. "He'll try to paint this as a witch hunt on the doctor's part."
"He won't get far," Mr. Picton pledged firmly. "Your earlier meeting with Mrs. Katie Stanton relates to another case, an unproved case that has yet to be officially investigated, and I can use that to our advantage here.
If Darrow even hints at what you were up to in New York, I'll get Judge Brown to slap him down for going outside the merits of this case."
"Yes," Miss Howard said, "but the fact that she knows we've been after Libby for so long is likely to make Mrs. Cady Stanton hostile, and she can be very persuasive when her blood's up."
Considering the possibility, Miss Howard kicked at one of the posts that held up the roof of the porch.
"Damn it, that man's clever."
The doctor had heard all of this, but hadn't commented on it. He was too busy reading his note from Dr. White, which seemed to cause him much concern.
"More good news, Kreitzler?" Mr. Moore asked, seeing the worried look on the doctor's face.
"It's certainly not what I was hoping for," the doctor answered with a shrug. "White says that, given the circumstances, he doesn't think it would be a good idea for us to meet before he's given his testimony. It's not the sort of attitude he would typically take."
"Maybe not," Mr. Picton said, "but it's consistent. Darrow's keeping a tight lid on everything and everyone connected to his case. I think he's been a little surprised by how prepared we've been, and wants to make sure he can offer some surprises of his own in return. That's certainly what we saw today."
"Well, surprisingly enough, it seems that we don't need to overreact to what happened today," Marcus advised, heading inside. "At least not according to the betting line at Canfield's."
"Where does he stay now?"
Cyrus asked, following Marcus into the house.
"No change," Mr. Moore called after them. "Still 60-1 against a conviction, and Canfield's finding a lot of takers even at those odds."
Without moving his eyes from the note he'd received, the doctor asked,
"And how much did you lose while ascertaining that information, Moore?"
Mr. Moore headed for the screen door.
"It could have been worse," he said, as he entered the house,
in an embarrassed way, what led me to believe that it couldn't have been very much worse. Still, expensive as it might have been, the news that them what were paying the most attention to the case, the heavy gamblers, didn't think our cause had been hurt by Mr. Darrow's antics of the afternoon was encouraging. And we were all able to sleep a little sounder, I think, because of it. Lucius was the last to turn in. He was due on the stand to talk about the circumstantial case against Libby Hatch the next morning, and he wanted to make sure he had all his ducks in a row before he let himself drift off. He was up early, too, and when I came downstairs I found him neatly dressed and pacing around the backyard, mumbling to himself and already sweating. Always cool as ice when it came to the business of investigation and scientific testing, he, much like myself, hated any kind of direct attention from crowds of strangers, and I think we all would have felt a little better if his much more diplomatic brother had been the one who was going to handle the testimony. But putting Marcus on the stand would have given Mr. Darrow the chance to hint, if not flat out declare, that he'd been personally scouted by the prosecution prior to the trial. A fact that, while it certainly didn't amount to anything illegal, might have been represented in a way what would have made us look desperate. And so it was Lucius who, at just past 10, took the oath and sat in the witness chair, ready to reveal all the details about Daniel Hatch's gun that he and his brother had put together during our stay in Ballston Spa. The courtroom had a different feel to it now, one brought on by the new faces what were visible behind the defense table. Dr. William Allenson White, a young, short man with spectacles, Mrs. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, looking her best, and finally a peculiar-looking mug who tried to make up for his unimpressive size by puffing himself up like a rooster. Dr. Albert Hamilton, the well-known ballistics expert. Dr. White and Mrs. Cady Stanton only offered the most formal of greetings to those members of our party they knew, making it clear from the outset that they didn't agree with what we were up to. And I don't think the strained nature of the situation did anything to help Lucius's nerves. Still, he held himself together very admirably, sitting and waiting to be questioned like he did it every day of his life. In fact, during Mr. Picton's questioning, the detective sergeant came off something like impressive. He didn't leave out any details, didn't hesitate in his answers, and didn't even sweat, or at least not much more than anyone else on that warm, humid August morning. In a funny kind of way, I was proud of him, being as I knew how much he hated the position he'd been forced into. It wasn't until the very end of his testimony that things started to get a little bumpy.
"Just a few more details, Detective Sergeant," Mr. Picton said. "You've told us approximately when the revolver was last fired, how many shots were expended, how just two bullets could have been responsible for the wounds inflicted on the three children, and how closely the bullet removed from the Hatcher's wagon matches the barrel of Daniel Hatcher's gun. But was there anything you came across during your inspection of the weapon that might lead you to hazard a guess as to who fired it last?"
"Yes, there was," Lucius answered quickly.
"And what was that?"
"We performed a dactyloscopy test. We compared the results to samples taken from household objects that belonged to the defendant. The match was perfect."
Once again, Mr. Darrow was out of his chair like a shot. "I object to this line of questioning, Your Honor," he said. "The state is attempting to enter evidence of a type that has never been accepted in an American court of law, and I'm sure they know it."
"Quite right," Judge Brown replied, turning what was becoming his usual critical glance to Mr. Picton.
"Unless the assistant district attorney is in possession of some new scientific data that established fingerprinting, which for the benefit of the jury is what he's talking about, as absolutely reliable, or unless he can provide me with a precedent for its being allowed in an American court, I cannot permit this testimony to continue."
"Your Honor need not allow it to continue," Mr. Picton said. "In fact, the state does not wish to continue. We acknowledge that fingerprinting is not yet accepted in American courts of law, despite the fact that it has been effectively used as evidence in courtrooms in Argentina."
"Mr. Picton," the judge warned, leveling his gavel.
"And despite the fact as well that the British government in India has ordered its use throughout that colony by police and prosecutors."
"Mr. Picton, enough," the judge yelled, banging the gavel.
"Your Honor," Mr. Picton said, putting his innocent look on again, "I beg the court's pardon, yet I feel I am misunderstood. I only mention these rather interesting and, to some ways of thinking, important facts. I do not say that the jury should give any weight to them simply because Argentines, Indians, and Englishmen do. After all, this is America, and things take time to be accepted here. I do not offer these tests as evidence. I offer them simply as a rather remarkable coincidence that may interest the jury."
Sitting down very quickly, Mr. Picton added, "I have no further questions, Your Honor."
By now, Judge Brown was rubbing hard at the leathery, wrinkled skin of his face with both hands. "Mr. Picton," he said, trying to keep his voice under control, "if I have ever heard such bald sophistry in a courtroom before, I cannot recollect it. You know perfectly well that anything offered by a witness in testimony must be considered evidence, or it is improper. I ought to hold you in contempt, sir. And if you try that kind of semantic trickery again, I will hold you in contempt. You are here to present acceptable evidence, not remark on interesting, unproven theories." Turning to the jury box, the judge bellowed, "The jury will disregard everything that was just said, and it will be stricken from the record." Then it was Lucius's turn. The judge spun on him and hollered, "And if you mention the subject of fingerprinting again, Detective Sergeant, I'll hold you in contempt, too." Lucius's forehead began to glow bright under the heat of those words.
"Yes, sir,"
he said sheepishly.
Hissing in exasperation, Judge Brown turned to the defense table.
"All right, Mr. Darrow, the witness is yours, and since I'm in a warning mood, let me tell you, sir, I don't want to see any hysterical theatrics of the variety that I witnessed yesterday. This trial is going to be run in an orthodox manner from here on out, and if either side crosses the line again, I'm going to lock everybody up."
Mr. Darrow couldn't hide a smile at that, and the judge pointed straight at his head with the gavel when he saw it.
"Don't make the mistake of taking this lightly, Mr. Darrow, or you'll find yourself on a train back to Chicago smarting like a whipped cur."
Mr. Darrow wiped the smile from his face as he came out from behind his table.
"Yes, Your Honor, I do apologize. You've been extremely patient."
"You're damn right I have," the judge said, causing the galleries to ripple with laughter. At the sound, the judge got to his feet and banged his gavel like a madman. "And that goes for the rest of you, too!" As quiet returned, the judge began to calm down. But only when the room was absolutely still did he sit, mumbling something about all my 40 years on a bench. Then he pointed at Mr. Darrow again with the gavel. "Well, get a move on, Counselor. I don't want to die before this trial is over."
Nodding, Mr. Darrow approached Lucius.
Detective Sergeant, in how many legal cases would you say has ballistics played an important role?
In the United States? Lucius asked.
Ah, yes, Detective Sergeant, Mr. Darrow answered. For the sake of his honor's nervous health, I think we'd better confine our discussion to the United States.
There were a lot of people who wanted to laugh just then, but nobody did.
Lucius shrugged.
There are some.
Can you give me a number?
No, I'm afraid I can't.
But all this business about your being able to determine when a gun was fired by the mold and rust on the thing that's been used before?
Several times. It began with the Mohan case in 1879. The defendant was exonerated when a gunsmith determined that because of the mold and rust accumulations in his pistol, the weapon could not have been fired in at least a year and a half. The murder in question had taken place during that time period.
Mr. Darrow shook his head, wandering over to the jury box. I don't know, Detective Sergeant. Maybe it's just me, but I've seen a lot of mold and rust in my life. Seems pretty amazing that you can date its growth as accurately as if it were a living creature.
Molds are living creatures, Lucius answered, taking the chance to needle Mr. Darrow in spite of his nervousness. And rust is simply the oxidization of metal which conforms to known timetables. Once you have the training, it's not terribly complex.
So you say, Detective. So you say. And I guess we have to accept your word on it for the moment. So, the gun was fired about 3 years ago, give or take a few months, and one of the bullets was found embedded in the wagon.
Mr. Darrow's face wrinkled up again.
I don't mean to sound dense, Detective. But what about that? The matching of the bullet to the gun, I mean. How many cases have been solved using those techniques?
Well, Lucius answered, a bit more uneasily, gunsmiths have been matching bullets to gun barrels for decades.
So it's an exact science, then?
That would depend on what you mean by exact.
I mean exact, Detective, Mr. Darrow said, walking back over to Lucius. Containing no margin for error.
Lucius shifted in his seat and then pulled out a handkerchief to wipe his forehead. There aren't many sciences that contain no margin for error.
I see, Mr. Darrow said. So it isn't exact. And what about that bullet? Any sign that it was actually involved in the murders?
There were traces of blood on it.
Any idea what kind of blood?
Lucius started to sweat even more visibly and wiped his head again. There aren't any tests as yet that can distinguish one type of blood from another.
Oh.
Doing his level best to look like he was honestly wrestling with the problem, Mr. Darrow moved back to the jury box.
So what you are, in sum, saying is that we have a gun that was fired about 3 years ago, by whom we certainly cannot say, and that was found at the bottom of a well behind the Hatches house. It may or may not have been the gun that fired a bullet that was found in the Hatches wagon. A bullet that may or may not have been involved in the murders. Is that about it, Detective?
I wouldn't characterize it that way, Lucius said.
The odds are high enough to leave room for reasonable doubt, Detective. At least in my mind. But let's try a question that maybe you can answer a little more precisely. In how many trials have you offered expert ballistic testimony?
Lucius was obviously taken completely off guard. How many?
It's a simple question, Detective.
Glancing down and going at his forehead one more time with the handkerchief, Lucius quietly said,
This is the first.
The first, Mr. Darrow answered, glancing quickly to the witness box, then back at the jury.
You're jumping into some pretty deep water for your first time swimming, don't you think?
Trying to put up a fight, Lucius answered, I've been studying ballistics for many years.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. It's just that nobody's thought to ask you for your opinion yet. I wonder why.
Finally, taking his eyes from the jurors, Mr. Darrow loped back over to his table.
That's all, sir.
Lucius started to get up, but Mr. Darrow raised a hand. Oh,
there is one more thing, Detective Sergeant. You stated during your opening remarks that you're a member of the New York City Police Department. Would you mind my asking, what's your current assignment?
Looking very startled, Lucius leaned back in the witness chair and tried to stall.
My current assignment? I was asked by the assistant district attorney to analyze...
I mean for your department, Mr. Darrow said.
Lucius took a deep breath.
My current assignment is unconnected to this case, and it would be inappropriate...
Isn't it true, Detective, Mr. Darrow interrupted, his voice rolling in a righteous way, that you were assigned several weeks ago to investigate Dr. Laszlo Kreitzler, specifically his role in the suicide of one of the children in his care at the Kreitzler Institute in New York City?
The crowd couldn't keep quiet at that, and as they started to chatter in surprise, Mr. Picton bolted out of his chair.
Objection, Your Honor, the State objects most strenuously. What possible bearing can the Detective Sergeant's current assignment have on this case?
The judge gaveled the galleries back to silence, then grabbed one of his ears and turned to Mr. Darrow.
Counselor, I had hoped that you were leaving the job of insinuation up to the Assistant District Attorney. What do you mean, sir, by bringing up such an apparently unrelated matter?
Your Honor, Mr. Darrow answered, I'm afraid I can't agree with the court's assessment of this information as unrelated. When the state's case rests so heavily on the work of one expert, and when that expert's integrity and competence are the subject of an investigation being conducted by another of the state's experts, well, Your Honor, the assistant district attorney is not the only man who can spot a remarkable coincidence.
The judge bashed his gavel down, his eyes getting hot.
Perhaps not, sir, but this court will not tolerate the introduction of coincidences by the defense any more than it will condone similar behavior by the state. If the matters you are touching on have some direct bearing on this case, then explain it right now, sir.
Mr. Darrow just held up his hands, taking his turn at playing innocent.
I apologize, Your Honor, if my remarks were inappropriate.
Inappropriate and inadmissible. The judge fired back.
The jury will ignore the defense's remarks concerning the witness's current assignment for the New York City Police Department, and those remarks will be stricken from the record.
The warning gavel was lifted once more toward the defense table. And don't try that kind of thing with me again, Mr. Darrow. I will tolerate no mention or exploration of any subject that does not concern this case and this case alone. Now proceed with your questions.
I have no further questions, Your Honor, Mr. Darrow answered, sitting down.
Mr. Picton, the judge said, do you wish to redirect?
If redirection could wipe the jury's memory clean of aspersions, Your Honor, Mr. Picton said, then I would redirect. As it cannot, I will not.
Then the detective sergeant is excused, Judge Brown answered, and the state may call its next witness.
The state, Mr. Picton announced, calls Mrs. Louisa Wright.
There was a small commotion at the back of the room as Mrs. Wright made her way in through the mahogany doors. Chapter 46. While the former housekeeper was walking down the aisle, the doctor leaned over to ask Mr. Picton, "What about Parker?" Mr. Picton shrugged.
Two of Dunning's deputies were supposed to escort him up on the early train this morning. They should have arrived by now. I'll have to get to him this afternoon.
Wearing an old-style blue dress, Mrs. Wright walked steadily and proudly through the gate in the oak railing, turning her gray-haired head and sharp features to the defense table just once, and registering no emotion of any kind when she saw Libby Hatch. To Bailiff Coffey's oath, she near yelled a solid, "I do!"
and then stated her name like she expected somebody to challenge her on it. It was an attitude which she never lost through all of Mr. Picton's opening questions, during which time he established a very clear picture of what life in the Hatch House had been like. Libby had been a woman of very changeable temperament, Mrs. Wright said, and when she felt that her own desires were being frustrated, she was capable of flying into extreme rages. Mr. Picton made sure the jury understood that Louisa Wright had no great love for Daniel Hatch and felt no jealousy toward her former mistress. As she told Miss Howard when we first got to town, the only people that she felt any genuine sympathy for or attachment to in the house were the three kids, who'd grown up so rattled by their father's crankiness and their mother's changeable moods that they sometimes seemed to be in a constant state of nervousness. "Now then, Mrs. Wright," Mr. Picton finally asked, after he'd painted this none-too-pleasing picture of the Hatch home, "when would you say that the Reverend Clayton Parker became a regular visitor to the house?" "Well," the old girl answered, mulling it over, "he generally dropped by at holidays, Christmas and such, and of course he took care of christening Clara, but he didn't start paying what you'd call regular social visits until later. Clara's first birthday, I think, was the first night he actually stayed to dinner."
"And how often did he visit after that?"
"Oh, at least once a week, and sometimes more often. Mr. Hatch was taking more of an interest in the church's business by then, you see. A lot of people do that when they start thinking that they don't have much time left." Mrs. Wright hadn't meant the statement as a joke, and she was surprised when they got a laugh from the galleries. "They will," she insisted, folding her hands tightly like she was embarrassed. "I've seen it happen."
"Of course you have," Mr. Picton answered. "But was Mr. Hatch's interest in the church the main reason for Reverend Parker's increased presence at the house?"
"Objection, Your Honor," Mr. Darrow droned. "The question calls for a speculative answer."
"I shall rephrase it then,"
Mr. Picton said, before the judge could order him to.
"Mrs. Wright, was it Mr. Hatch that the Reverend spent the greater portion of time with during his visits?"
"No, sir," Mrs. Wright answered with a little scoff. "After all, how long does it take to write a check?"
That got more laughs out of the crowd, and the judge responded in his usual manner with irritated raps of his gavel. Leaning over, he scolded Mrs. Wright gently. "The witness will please try to keep the element of sarcasm out of her responses."
"I am, sir," she answered, looking a little offended. "That's all Mr. Hatch did when the Reverend came, write checks. And maybe talk for a few minutes about theology. The rest of the time it was the missus that looked after their guest."
"And why was that?" Mr. Picton asked.
"I'm sure I couldn't say," Mrs. Wright replied. "I only know what I saw 6 or 7 times.
"And what did you see?"
Stiffening her back and narrowing her eyes, Mrs. Wright lifted a pointing finger in the direction of the defense table.
"I saw that woman and the Reverend Parker, out in the birch grove, about 1/4 mile from the house."
"And what were they doing?"
"They were not doing the sort of thing that a reverend generally does with a married woman,"
Mrs. Wright answered, as offended as she would have been if the incidents had occurred just yesterday. The judge sighed wearily.
"Mrs. Wright, the question is a direct one. Do please try to make your answers follow suit. I've got enough wordplay to contend with in this case."
Mrs. Wright looked up at the bench, a shocked look on her face.
"Do you mean I should just say what I mean?"
The judge tried to smile.
"It would be most refreshing."
Mrs. Wright folded her hands in her lap.
"Well, I don't know it. But if you order me to, Judge, well..."
She took a deep breath and went on. "The first time I went looking for the missus, being as Clara'd been taken sick, I saw her in the birch grove with the Reverend. They had their arms around each other. They were... kissing."
More mumbles in the crowd knitted more raps of the gavel from the judge.
"And the other times?"
Mr. Picton asked.
"The other times? Well..."
Mrs. Wright shifted uneasily.
"Some of them were the same, but others, well... it was the middle of summer, those times. Warm, like now.
The ground's soft in that grove, with a fine moss bed. And that's all I'm going to say, judge or no judge, court or no court. I'm a decent woman.
Mr. Picton nodded. And we certainly wouldn't ask you to behave in an indecent manner, but let me put the question to you this way, Mrs. Wright. Would it be accurate to say that you observed the defendant and Reverend Parker in a state of partial or complete undress? Now, starting to positively squirm, Mrs. Wright nodded.
Yes, sir, it would.
And engaged in physical intimacy? Her discomfort seeming to turn to anger, Mrs. Wright barked,
"Yes, sir, and her with a husband and the sweetest little girl anybody could ever wish for back of the house. Disgraceful, I call it."
Nodding as he started to pace before the witness chair, Mr. Picton slowly asked, "I don't suppose you could give me precise dates for these events?"
"Not precise, sir, no."
"No, but let me ask you this. Would you feel sure saying that they preceded the births of Matthew and Thomas Hatch by at least 9 months?"
"Your Honor," Mr. Darrow called out, "I'm afraid the State is indulging its taste for suggestion again."
"I'm not so sure I agree with you this time, Counselor," the judge answered. "The State, though they have been an infernal nuisance about it, have introduced evidence that speaks to opportunity and means in this case. I'm going to allow them to start approaching the question of motive, but you do it carefully, Mr. Picton."
Looking like he could have kissed that white fuzzy head what was bobbing behind the bench, Mr. Picton said,
"Yes, Your Honor,"
and then turned back to his witness.
"Well, Mrs. Wright, would you say that the timing was about right, with respect to the birth of the two younger Hatch children?"
"It was awfully close," Mrs. Wright replied with a nod. "I remember remarking on it to myself at the time, and when the boys came out looking the way they did, well, I drew my own conclusions."
"And how was it that they looked?" Mr. Picton stole a glance up at the bench. "I ask you not to be presumptuous here, Mrs. Wright." Wagging a finger toward the defense table again, Mrs. Wright said, "Those boys didn't get their coloring, their eyes, their skin, their hair, from Mr. or Mrs. Hatch. Anybody could see that. And there was something else, too. When you live in the house that you work in, you get to know its rhythms, so to speak. Mrs. Hatch slept in a separate bedroom from Mr. Hatch. When they were first married, they spent some nights together in his room. But after Clara came, well, Mr. Hatch never slept anywhere but in his own bed. And if the Mrs. ever went into Mr. Hatch's room again, other than to take him food and medicine when he was dying, I certainly didn't witness it."
"I see. Then when was the last time you saw Mrs. Hatch go into her husband's room?"
"The night the children were shot," Mrs. Wright answered. "She was flying all through the house. I couldn't stop her. I was too busy trying to help the children. But she locked herself into Mr. Hatch's old room for a good 5 minutes."
"Locked herself?" Mr. Picton repeated. "How did you know that she locked the door?"
"She was in there when the sheriff and Dr. Lawrence came," Mrs. Wright answered with a shrug. "They tried to get to her so Dr. Lawrence could give her something to calm her down. But the door was locked. After a few more minutes, she came back out, still screaming and running all around. She said she'd found her husband's gun and that she was afraid she was going to do herself some injury with it. She told me to get rid of the thing, so I wrapped it up in a paper bag and dropped it down the old well."
"And do you remember what kind of paper bag it was?"
Mrs. Wright nodded. "Mr. Hatch had bought everything in bulk to save money. We still had a whole crate of bags from Mr. West's factory."
Mr. Picton moved to his table and picked up the piece of paper bag what Lucius had cut away from the Colt revolver the evening he found the thing.
"So the bag would have borne this imprint."
He handed her the snippet of brown paper. Studying the thing, Mrs. Wright nodded.
"Yes, that's right."
"You're sure?"
"Certainly I'm sure. You see, 2 years ago, West's bag company moved this writing here from the bottom of the bags to up around the top. If you have enough of the things, you notice."
"And do you have enough of the things?"
"Yes, sir. I never throw them away. A widow living on an army pension can't be too careful about expenses."
"No, of course not. Well, thank you, Mrs. Wright. I have no more questions."
Mr. Picton sat down, still looking very pleased that none of Mrs. Wright's testimony had been excluded from the record. Mr. Darrow, on the other hand, seemed to be going through one of those on-the-spot strategy shifts of his,
Holding his hands in front of his face and knitting his brows tight over his eyes, he waited a minute or two before saying anything or moving.
"Mr. Darrow," the judge asked, "do you have questions for this witness?"
Finally, showing some movement but only in his eyes, Mr. Darrow mumbled,
"Just one or two, Your Honor."
Then, after another pause, he stood up.
"Mrs. Wright, did you ever observe anything in the defendant's behavior that would have led you to believe that she might have been capable of murdering her own children?"
Mr. Picton, who'd only just settled into his chair, got right back up.
"I must object to that, Your Honor. The witness is not qualified to speak to such matters. We have alienists who will tell us what the